Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to be moderating today's webinar on the permissibility of fees in the accounts receivable management industry. One of the great debates during the past few years in the credit collection industry has been how best to manage convenience fees when accepting payments via debit cards and credit cards. Today, we're fortunate to be joined by a panel of payment and compliance experts who are with us to talk about the fee-free model and why it is becoming more popular. This webinar is being sponsored by Lucent Pay. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the RM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of emails, newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the RM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use. It's a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it's got to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. John Bedard is a nationally recognized authority on the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and the Fair Credit Reporting Act. He serves as counsel to several professional trade associations, including the Georgia Collectors Association. John is a former member of the board of directors of the industry's leading professional trade organization, ACA International. He serves as the State of Georgia Compliance Chairperson for ACA International and is a former chairperson and program designation award recipient of ACA International's Members Attorney Program. Mike Frost is a partner at Malone Frost Martin. His practice is primarily focused on compliance, general counsel services, and litigation defense for the RM industry. He has more than 15 years of experience as an executive at a large collection agency where he was responsible for legal, compliance, government affairs, legal operations, sales, and marketing. Mike serves on the board of directors at ACA International and is a speaker on a variety of industry topics for many trade associations. David Whiteley recently started his own company based out of Los Angeles, focusing on providing software vendors the first full end-to-end ACH and card platform with instant settlement and the ability to automate the acquiring payment processing element of their business. David started his experience in management, leading top-producing sales teams within the telecom, real estate, and banking industries before moving into the payment space. Working for major processors such as Global Payments, he has worked alongside two companies in risk, underwriting, compliance, and operations roles as the company scaled and exited or sold their businesses to larger processors. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to ask questions, and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing. And when the discussion has concluded, to submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available later today on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, before we launch into the discussion, I wanted to ask everybody to reserve a minute and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over today. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Participating in the feedback survey helps me develop content that's what you're looking for and find the speakers like the ones we've got today who are the people you want to hear from. So I thank you in advance for participating. With that, let's turn this webinar over to the discussion portion of our event today. Let's start at the high level and let's talk about what is a convenience fee and how they're used in the RM industry and maybe how convenience fees are different from surcharges. And Mike Frost, since you're up on my screen right now, we'll give you the honor of taking the first question today.
Oh, thanks. and thanks again for having me, Mike, and to Lucent Pay as well. I think everybody knows that this has been kind of a hot topic, especially on the regulatory front for many years. So it's always fun to work through some of the issues and talk through what options are out there. Really, I'll take the last question first, which is how is it different? How is a convenience fee different from a surcharge? And I think the easiest way to differentiate the two is a surcharge is really something that you see as a local option tax, an ATM fee. So if you want to use the product or service, this is, you know, what the cost is going to be. I think what we're dealing with on a convenience fee perspective is really a little bit different by stating something to the effect of if you'd like a different form of a transaction or if you'd like to utilize this type of payment option, there's a fee for that payment option if you so choose to. Convenience fees have been around for many, many, many years in the collection space. They've taken on a variety of different paths. I probably won't be able to touch on all of them. And John and Dave, the other panelists, please feel free to jump in if you've got some to add there. But, you know, when convenience fees, my first introduction to them was probably back in 2004 when agencies were charging their own fees internally. And there's a wide variety of how people did it. They either had percentage fee basis on accounts where a consumer would select a different form of payment, or there's companies that utilize flat fees or flat, a $4.95 charge for a convenience fee transaction. Some agencies I know charged only the fee on the first transaction. Some charged them on all transactions. So there was a wide variety. Some added them to the balance of the account. Some of them had separate transactions that showed up in the consumer's banking ledger as a completely separate transaction than the initial one. So a lot of people did it in various different ways, and it wasn't really a clear-cut path on exactly how that process needed to be administered. So agencies did their best to make sure that they were in compliance with all the laws, rules, and regulations, but there wasn't a lot of case law, and there was really no administrative or regulatory bulletins or perspectives on the topic. So people were really doing the best they could to ensure compliance. What we saw a lot in the early days of the CFPB was really an understanding that charging those fees internally probably wasn't proper based on some of the other regulations that we'll get into later. But then we saw this new process kind of unfold. Like very many great companies that we have in the industry, or vendors that we have in the industry, they look at an issue or a problem and they find a solution for it. And I think that that's largely what we're going to be talking today, is some of the solutions that are out there that make this process viable again for, and feasible again for, agencies to pass the regulatory scrutiny and litigation muster for these types of processes.
Excellent. Thanks, Mike. John, David, anything to add on top of that?
No, I mean, this is Bedard. Mike's got that all buttoned up. You know, he's right. You know, 10, 15 years ago, we did see the sort of the internal charging of the fees in many agencies. And Mike, I think you'll agree, there are some agencies that really did calculate those fees based upon some targeted revenue projections, and that really caused them to actually have these fees be a bit of a revenue generator for them. I don't see that anymore. I don't know if you see that anymore, but that has all been but eliminated from what we've seen here in our office. But nonetheless, there are consumers and attorneys who are still bringing claims on the basis that these fees are somehow not lawful. And the thing that is most important is what you touched on, Mike, which is that there are now solutions in the marketplace that allow agencies to address the cost associated with transactions in a way that still remains faithful to the rules.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think a lot of the agencies too, even back in the days, 15 years ago, when convenience fees really started to really garner some attention, most of the agencies that I had dealt with at that time were really trying to do exactly what the third-party processing element does today, which is really just offset the fee. They weren't looking at it from a revenue standpoint. Now, you did see from time to time companies getting hit on, $21.95, per transaction on every single transaction for a $400 debt. Obviously, there's some excessive charges there, and there's probably some UDAP concerns and things like that. But for the most part, I think what agencies tried to do is develop and draft policies that identified what those expenses were going to be from an outsource perspective, because there was not a third-party payment process like this. So they were trying to figure out, on average, is it best to utilize a percentage-based fee or a flat fee? And as we all know, there's a million different types of debt out there, whether it's auto or healthcare or bank card or whatever it may be. some of those probably warrant a different treatment than others. And that's probably where most of those agencies fell on either a flat fee or a percentage-based fee, because they didn't want to create a very large charge for a consumer that didn't make sense, because they were really just trying to offset that processing or transactional fee there. But I do agree with you, John. There's probably some that acted in that manner, but I think those days are long gone.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, we've mentioned rules, we've mentioned laws. Let's talk a little bit about that. Let's start at the federal level. John, what federal laws govern the charging of convenience fees?
Well, I mean, for collectors, this is no mystery to anybody on the call. For collectors, it's the FDCPA, right? Because the FDCPA talks about debt collectors collecting any charges, any interest, any other fees, quote, incidental to the principal obligation, unless those fees are authorized by the underlying agreement between the creditor and the consumer, or they're authorized by law. And so that creates the issue of whether or not, one, these kind of transaction fees are, quote, incidental to the principal obligation, and whether or not they constitute, quote, any fee, interest, charge, or expense associated with the collection of the account. And so the FDCPA is the starting point for debt collectors, but that's not the ending point. Now, we've got a lot of cases under the FDCPA that talk about whether or not these fees are incidental to the principal obligation, and there are many cases that find that they are. There are some cases that find that they are not. But what a lot of those cases don't really focus on is whether or not the debt collector is charging them. And so in almost all of those cases, those fees are being charged by the collector, or at least collected by the collector, and then the fee goes to wherever it needs to go, either the third-party processor or kept internally by the agency. But the solutions that we find in the marketplace now are actually creating processes in which the collector is not collecting the fee at all, which then gives rise to a very good reason about why this section of the FDCPA doesn't apply to that behavior at all. But like I mentioned, that's the beginning of the analysis, not the end, because then there's an entire layer of state law that collectors should be aware of when it comes to the application or the collection of these kind of fees. There are many states, several in the country, that address this issue, and there are many states that prohibit the collection of these fees. And so the answer to your question is twofold as to what law really applies here when it comes to collectors. We've got federal law, and we've also got this layer of state law in which certain states don't allow the application of these fees.
Thank you very much, John. Before we get into the state law, which is going to be my next question, I'd like to hit the pause button briefly on the discussion today and invite Michael McDonald from LucentPay to say a few words. Mike?
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to be involved with the panel. And again, what I would like to state is, for anybody looking at this type of technology, it's great to have this kind of dialogue with industry experts. But, specific to LucentPay, our goal is to be a strategic partner for our clients as it comes to their payment processing needs. And really all of our solutions we've built around helping them drive greater profitability. And, part of that is, helping mitigate risk through our no-cost to biller model, where, again, we are looking to build it within a framework that helps them maintain compliance with FDCPA and the various state laws. And then also with our online technology, building out multi-channel payment options, whether it's IVR, online, whatever the case may be, having tools that allow them to maximize consumer engagement and build the best possible outcomes both for the consumer and their agency. So, again, very much appreciate the opportunity to be involved today.
Excellent. Thank you. And thanks again to LucentPay for sponsoring today's webinar. Really appreciate your support. John brought up the subject of state laws, so let's talk about that for a little bit. David, do you want to weigh in, maybe start the discussion on the different state laws that companies in the ARM industry should be aware of as they apply to the charging of convenience fees?
Sure. And again, I also appreciate the opportunity to be part of this call. And I also let the legal counsel on the call speak to some of this as well. I think just to, take kind of one quick step back to being in the payment space, at least in my background, one of the most important aspects of it is one, not only understanding, understanding all the stakeholder rules, right? So not just state, federal, but also the, the card brand compliance such as Visa and MasterCard. So that's why it's important, to make sure that, if you're conducting a model where it's offsetting, this payment processing expense, that you're doing it with a company that really understands not only the payment processing, but also the accounts receivables or collection space, and then also understands, some of these regulations. One of my key roles was really identifying and kind of finding that delineation between, agencies that were clean and compliant, which I would say are the majority, but then you also have some quote unquote bad actors, that may be, adding the fees, in a non-compliant way, just to eliminate their payment processing expense. Obviously the end goal here is, Michael with LucentPay was mentioning, the end goal here is to, ultimately help to offset some of this expense, which may be cutting into what are already small margins, and that may not be covered by the creditors or their clients. But within the, the state laws, there's several, that clearly prohibit, the charging of any additional fees. Those are, run off that list here in a second. But there's also states where there could be some case law, that shows that they may be a little bit more aggressive. And again, I'll kind of point that towards our legal counsel on the call. But those states where they're not allowed is Colorado, Connecticut, Kansas, Massachusetts, Maine, Oklahoma, North Carolina, and New York. But I'll direct the call, point the call to a gentleman on a call that are covering from a legal aspect to maybe touch on the states where there's case law to support. Maybe it might be wise to avoid some of those states as well.
Mike, John, want to jump in?
This is Bedard. Look, David's hit the nail on the head. You don't want to be collecting in the states that prohibit it, period. They've been clear about it in their rules or their statutes, and, collectors would be wise to heed those rules. That having been said, that doesn't mean that it can't be done properly, or at least with reduced risk in other states. But the key here is who is charging the fee? Who is charging the fee? I think, so long as a debt collector, is not charging the consumer the fee, I think that goes a long way towards reducing risk. And there are solutions out there that allow payment processing to go that way. Mike McDonald will even share with us maybe later on how some of those solutions operate. That having been said, the Bureau has not been silent on what it believes the role of payment, phone pay fees plays in the marketplace. And I can share with you a little bit on what the Bureau's position on it is. And for everybody that's listening, the Bureau has issued a compliance bulletin, which I affectionately refer to as rulemaking circumvention devices. But nonetheless, it's a compliance bulletin. It's the 2017-01 compliance bulletin, came out in July of 2017. And the subject of that bulletin is phone pay fees. And it talks about the role of phone pay fees in the financial services marketplace. But there's a specific section in that bulletin on the role of phone, what they call phone pay fees in the collection space. And it provides examples of conduct in the ARM industry that may violate or risk violating the FDCPA. Because the Bureau's position is that a debt collector is prohibited from charging these fees unless the amount is expressly authorized by the agreement creating the debt or permitted by law. And that necessarily means that silence in the law, according to the CFPB, is not express permission. And therefore, when collectors are reviewing state laws around the country and state law does not address the issue, the Bureau's position is that it would not be permissible under state law because the state law does not expressly permit it. And so nonetheless, the Bureau then goes on to explain its expectations with respect to these kind of fees. And it's got a laundry list of recommendations that it thinks collectors under the FDCPA ought to do to comply with the FDCPA and also to comply with the UDEP obligations of Dodd-Frank. And I'm not going to read through this laundry list of recommendations here, but anybody interested in learning the Bureau's position on it can take a look at that. The other thing that the Bureau makes specific point of is production incentive programs. And Mike Frost, we may have seen this 10, 15 years ago, maybe even 20 years ago, production incentives in which collectors would actually provide incentives to agents who collected convenience fees. I can't even remember the last time I had that issue come up in our office. It just does not happen in our, anymore that we have seen. But the Bureau apparently has seen it in more recent times and makes specific mention of production incentive programs and how those kind of programs can be especially risky to consumers. And so the bulletin talks about that as well. It talks about some disclosures. And I really think what the Bureau is getting at is this idea of informed choice. And that in order to reduce consumer risk in the marketplace, consumers really need to be able to make informed choices about their payment methods and about the fees they might pay for those payment methods.
Yeah, John, I think you did a great job of summarizing that. I would just, add to that real briefly by answering the question too is, yeah, I haven't seen that either. Many, many, many moons ago, you may have seen as this first concept first started to kick off that immediately as a collection operator, you want your convenience fees to get paid. So what would you normally do? You would try to incent those that are working on the phones to get those convenience fees. But that quickly took a different angle, I think, as people understood that this is, really summarized with this 2017 order. And as John suggested, everybody should take a look at that. But there's really four main points that I've seen in that bulletin. And the first one is just really disclosure. Is there going to be a problem for a collection agency that's allowing the convenience fee transaction through a third-party processor? There could be a problem if you fail to disclose the payment methods, alternative options. So how could the consumer make a payment without having to pay a convenience fee? And then disclosing all of the different payment processes and payment options and amounts associated with that. The second would be a misrepresentation. The CFPB is always looking for those disclosures and how those disclosures are stated and how they're interpreted by a consumer. So are you leading somebody down the path to try to get to the highest convenience fee amount? Today, in today's world with the third-party processor, that's probably less of a significant issue because it's not the agency that's collecting the money and keeping the money. It's being collected and maintained by the third-party payment processor. So it kind of takes away that misrepresentation. But again, there's a focus there. To make sure that that's being represented properly to consumers. And the third is really what we've seen a lot of as debt collectors is your process and service oversight. So whether you're a creditor and you're outsourcing information or outsourcing your past due accounts to a third-party collection agency, there has to be a level of oversight there, no different than what you see with a collection agency working with vendors. So there has to be a level of oversight on that service of the vendor, as well as your internal processes and the individuals making the disclosures on the phones. So the CFPB is going to look for a very meticulous process that ensures compliance with those rules and ensuring that you're inspecting what you expect your agents to be doing on the phone. And the fourth one, like John touched on, is the incentives. You can't drive to a specific form of payment. And, you know, that's the fourth one that really goes into some detail on making sure that you don't have that process set up or it doesn't sneak into your operation somehow. But, as John stated, this is an area that if you're not charging convenience fees today, you're thinking about the process, this is probably where I would start. And then look at some of the case law. We mentioned earlier that there are some cases out there. The cases to this third-party payment processing are actually very positive. We've seen some in the Sixth Circuit where, the courts have said, hey, this was not collected by the defendant, but it was a third-party charge that was triggered when the debtor chose the option of paying by credit card or whatever form of payment. So the courts are looking at this and understanding, hey, it's not the agency, it's not an incidental fee because it's being charged by a third party after the consumer actually chooses that form of payment and the disclosures are provided. We've also seen it in New York where courts have said, the fees did not violate the act, where it's not paid to the debt collector and instead paid to a third party in exchange for voluntarily utilizing a particular method of payment. So if you look at the Shami case versus National Enterprises Systems in the Eastern District of New York, as well as the Sixth Circuit case, which was called Lewis versus ACB Business Services, those are two cases that you can look at to understand that this process has actually been vetted in a few areas in the judiciary and have come out with some positive results. That's not a full rendition of all the litigation that's been out there for years. Some go the opposite way. So you'll have to look at where you're charging the fees, how you're charging the fees, and looking at all those different processes internally to set up your internal processes with that third party payer.
Excellent. Thanks, everyone, for contributing on that. You did mention a couple of cases, Mike, with respect to the case law. Are there any other cases that companies or individuals should be aware of, as it pertains to convenience fees or anything in this area?
There's one in the Northern District of Illinois. Acosta is the name, versus Credit Bureau of Napa County. That was another one where it was a pass-through process to a third party and it was found to be fine. I probably can't give you a reiteration of all the cases that are out there. And there probably are some negative ones. The ones that I'm thinking of that are negative, there was one in Illinois as well, but this was back in 2004, 2005. So it was back when agencies were generating those convenience fees themselves. And even back in that day, you saw cases where they were siding with the agencies and siding against the agencies. So I don't know that we get a really clear line, but you do have some supporting cases, even at the Sixth Circuit level. So you're looking at an appellate level decision, and those are good to always at that level to have something to apply to instead of just the district court cases.
David, I'm curious from an operations perspective, how do you take all of this compliance requirements and these different issues, both from a legal as well as from a rulemaking or law or a legislative perspective, incorporated into an operation, payment processing operation within a collection agency? How does that sort of actually translate?
If I understand the question correctly, I mean, if you're really kind of referring to, I guess, operationally from, I guess, the underwriting standpoint at the time that we, take on a new collection agency client for payment processing.
We've talked a little bit about those first steps. I'm just curious how the an agency would, how you'd advise an agency to sort of build out, a payment processing operation?
I guess from my perspective, and just what's worked well in the past is quite honestly, focusing on core competency, at least from my perspective, relying on strong, solid, outside legal counsel, and then, partnering with a strong vendor, such as LucentPay, that, understands, all the compliance elements and that can kind of take, some of that burden, off of you, because otherwise it becomes, pretty rocky, river to kind of navigate through all the various rules and laws and still, operate a business. I mean, there's still, a fair level of complexity to it, especially once you incorporate whatever creditor, client guidelines they may have on how that, fee may be collected as well. And then how you kind of apply that fee across, if you're collecting in multiple states, of course, how you, collect that fee in a way that kind of is in less of a risk, exposure area than others. So.
Got it. Thank you.
This is Bedard. We would be remiss not to also mention that the Federal Trade Commission has not been silent on this issue as well. And there's a really nice, to the extent there's such a thing as a really nice consent order, that's kind of an oxymoron, but nonetheless, there is a final stipulated order that was entered back in 2013, Federal Trade Commission versus Jacob Law Group, PLLC. It was in the Northern District of Georgia in the Atlanta Division. And in that case, this stipulated order goes through the kind of things that the FTC expects a debt collector to disclose to a consumer when it comes to charging a fee associated with the payment, with a payment being made by the consumer. And so, for example, disclosing to the consumer the purpose of the payment or the fee, how many times it's going to be charged, what the amount of the fee is, the nature of the fee, that kind of thing. And so that's some nice guidance with respect to what the Federal Trade Commission expects debt collectors to be doing when it comes to properly charging fees associated with payment transactions to consumers.
Thank you. I was just going to ask you about the FTC, so you took that question literally right out of my mouth. I appreciate that. Can you guess what my next question is going to be?
No.
I'm curious, what I'd like to spend a few minutes on, and we've talked a little bit about it in reference to some of the other answers, but how companies can work with their clients as it pertains to whether a convenience fee can be charged, how you sort of manage that aspect of the collector-creditor relationship. Do you have any insights or perspective that you can share on that?
This is Mike Ross. I can take that because I've, working in-house with a collection agency for 15 years, I mean, we dealt with, creditor issues all the time, whether it was a convenience fee issue or some other type of issue, the Foley versus Dortmund or whatever the type of claims are. The main thing is to have a good rapport with those clients and understand who it is within their legal department that's making the calls or determinations on whether things can be added to the balances of an account or what type of processes you're using at the agency that they're going to allow or not allow. So at the end of the day, those are the debts are owned by the creditor, obviously, and they have a overwhelming need from a regulatory perspective to have some oversight of their vendors, who are the collection agencies. So with all of that understood, you need to really have your compliance department should have, if they don't today, they need to work on getting them, is good working relationships with the creditors that you're working on behalf of. And they can have the dialogue with the compliance personnel at the creditor shops. Years ago, we had a thing called REMA. REMA used to provide round trip cables for the banks. So we would have an opportunity to get, as a vendor, to get in front of 20 different large banks. And we would just have open dialogue and discussion about relative compliance issues in the third-party collection space. and work through those. And that would, the convenience fees would come up. Those were questions that would get asked, and we would work through them and identify how we were implementing our policies and procedures. And they'd give, not advice, but they'd give recommendations, or they'd come back and tell you that they're opposed to charging the fee or whatever the other compliance issue may be. But you would always need to be able to work through that and explain to them, whether it's, you know, providing that FTC opinion that John mentioned, or the CFPB bulletin, or providing case law that will show that the processes that you put in place are going to pass muster, either from a regulatory review or through a litigation. And that, then really show them that you have the thing locked down. So if you do have a convenience fee process and you're charging those fees, or you're, I'm sorry, your third party is charging those fees, that you're inspecting what you expect. So we have all heard about the different types of technology today for ensuring compliance, the voice analytics, all of those types of processes can easily pull that information out of those phone calls to validate whether that information, those disclosures are provided accurately or not. And in today's day and age, we're starting to see artificial intelligence and machine learning come into play to be able to provide those disclosures verbatim. And exactly how the agency's policies and procedures are drafted and created. So those are probably the areas that you really think of first, which is, you know, how do you get all of that information in front of the creditor? One, educate them. Some of them are going to have a lot more information about these types of processes that you're working on, and some don't have any idea at all. So first and foremost is educate them on the processes, educate them on the regulations, on the law, interpretation. And then make a decision on whether you can do that or not.
Hey, Mike, this is Bedard. Did those dialogues that you had with creditors, did that include a discussion on the content of the underlying agreements with consumers and the potential for those agreements to just have authorized these kind of fees?
Absolutely. We would even get into, collection fees. And we would help draft language to certain creditors on how to capture the right type of authorization, what's absolutely needed in those authorizations to be able to litigate the cases and be successful. So whether it was a collection fee or convenience fee or any other type of fee or process, those discussions got into the details on what needed to get set up at the underlying consumer agreements, as well as what we've seen in TCPA. So we've had a lot of clients that have, you know, modified their, you know, patient intake forms or their new credit card agreements that absolutely have ways for us to communicate as a vendor of the creditor through the authorizations that the consumers give to the creditor in the past through the agencies. So, I think most agencies probably have good relationships with their clients or they wouldn't be vendors for very long. But it's really taken those relationships to that next level to be able to help them craft at that stage of the game what's being said and what's being agreed to by the consumer so it flows downstream and all works properly through the entire billing cycle.
I think what you just said is probably the top takeaway from this call today, which is to communicate with your own clients about the issues and work through solutions. And one of the solutions you just shared with everybody is having clients change the content of their agreements to all but eliminate the kind of risk that we're talking about here on the phone. Now, look, I am not naive. I know that debt collectors often do not have very much influence over the content of the underlying agreement that a creditor has with a consumer. But nonetheless, Mike, in your experience, you did have those communications with clients, and you did have clients that were receptive to that because they understood, too, that not only does it reduce risk for you, it reduces risk for them, and it's better for everybody. And so I think that's a great takeaway for folks on the call today.
Excellent. Just taking notes. Thank you very much. David, I'm curious, maybe we looking in this idea of takeaways, maybe you can list some of the questions that collection agencies should be asking either when seeking guidance on convenience fees or when, you know, sort of, you know, looking to sort of incorporate this, you know, this sort of payment processing model into their operation.
Sure. I mean, I would start with asking some of the basic questions that cover, you know, the topics and areas that we mentioned on this call. And what I mean by that is, you know, ask, you know, are there certain states where they will, you know, block the transactions? Obviously, not everyone, not every processor is going to, you know, at times they'll leave that up to the merchant's discretion. But I think it's important to ask those sort of questions that help kind of, you know, that helps you point in the right direction to help you understand whether or not they really understand the rules, you know, and the regulations. And I would get into, you know, obviously, you may have to, you know, sign an NDA or something of that sort, but I would get into, quite frankly, the details into just the overall structure, you know, of their program, you know, how it works, how they maintain their compliance, you know, because obviously these rules can change as we talked about the different bulletins on this call, and even understanding, quite honestly, what's really even more important on a deeper level is finding out which banks they're using, because the processor is really going to be at the mercy of the bank that they're using. And there's certain banks that are going to be, you know, more knowledgeable of, you know, all of these various items, such as the, you know, collections industry, you know, the state laws for, you know, convenience fees and things like that, or additional fees. But it's really, that's a key component, because if the bank, you know, doesn't understand and they kind of, you know, somewhat blindly, but not completely blindly, but they somewhat blindly get into supporting a processor that has, you know, this type of model, they could realize once they get some sort of, you know, notification that it's not compliant or what have you, it could cause them to kind of overcompensate and tighten up, and it could cause an issue with kind of sustainability and longevity of the account with that processor and that bank. So I would say that those are probably the most key components. And it's really just a matter of you're almost vetting your payment processor just to make sure they understand everything that's involved, and that they're staying on top of all the changes as they occur, and that they have some sort of good, you know, legal in-house or you know, external outside legal counsel.
Awesome. Excellent. Thank you, David. John, Mike, any questions you would add to that list for companies when looking at, you know, looking at payment processing or, you know, looking at convenience fees?
Well, what I always tell clients is, you know, often in my experience, it's not the compliance department that is endeavoring the exploration of adding these fees to accounts, right? It's, you know, it's executive management, it's operations, it's other people in the company. And that's, I'm not making a judgment about that, but what I do encourage clients to do is whenever they make decisions about the workflow and the processes that they use in their company, is to make sure that those changes are first vetted through their compliance management system. Because it's the compliance management system that will be designed to identify risk and to reduce it and to implement change at the company in ways that expose the company and consumers to the least amount of risk possible. To say it in a much more simple way is, don't make changes in the company without first vetting it through your compliance management system. And that's just not unique to this particular issue. It applies to all changes in process that happen at a company, and mature compliance management systems will help companies find solutions to even the most difficult problems.
Excellent, thank you. I'd like to maybe sort of ask each of the panelists to pull out their crystal balls for a second and maybe share some insights into how they see the federal government or state legislatures addressing this topic from a lawmaking perspective going forward. Do you see more states you know, sort of restricting the use of convenience fees, or do you see that, you know, fewer states, you know, and then sort of at the federal level, do you foresee any changes there with regard to this topic?
This is Mike, and I you know, that's kind of a loaded question because I'm not sure what any of us can really understand how the states specifically are coming up with some of the rules that they come up with. But I think we've seen some of this piggybacking. As one state creates a rule, another state may create a rule, and the federal government's always looking at those state rules too as they're promulgating rules themselves. And I'll leave the CFPB piece to John, because he mentioned to me on a call earlier about a piece of the CFPB proposed rules that he had found in it. So I won't take his thunder there, because he absolutely deserves credit for finding this that it's mentioned in there. But the states are ones that, for me, are more problematic. One, because it's more difficult from a compliance perspective when you have, you know, 20 or 30 different state rules that you're trying to coordinate. But I think the best thing to do is really watch some of the industry publications that come out about some of that state legislative proposed rules or bills that may come out, and then make sure that you're working in the grassroots areas in those specific states to try to shape those bills into the legislation that you can live with. That's probably the best way to look for that. I don't know that I have a crystal ball that says what states are going to be enacting legislation like this in the near future or attempting to. But I would just say, you know, make sure that you stay attuned to that and are participating in those industry events when there's an opportunity to get in front of the state legislatures, just no different than what we do on the federal level. Other than that, I can, you know, turn it over to John on the CFPB side.
Well, you know, look, you cannot renew your driver's license online without paying a convenience. You can't renew your automobile registration. You can't even pay your state or federal taxes online without paying a convenience fee. And so my crystal ball on my desk here is jumping up and down, screaming that it would be the most extreme demonstration of hypocrisy for the government to prohibit the marketplace from charging the very same fees for the convenience of making payments in non-cash ways. That doesn't mean they're not going to do it, and that doesn't mean that some states haven't done it already, but I have a jaded crystal ball, because that's just not right. That having been said, you know, the Bureau's notice of proposed rulemaking basically parrots the statute when it comes to the prohibition on charging any amounts, I want to be careful about language, about collecting any amounts that are incidental to the principal obligation. But that having been said, it's hard to sort of read between the lines on if the Bureau means something different than the statute. The Bureau does define the term any amount and uses the very same words that the statute uses. When it talks about any amount, maybe there's an opportunity to, for the Bureau's words here to be interpreted slightly differently than the statute. I don't know. We'll see what the final rule says. The Bureau doesn't say much about it other than to attempt to parrot what the statute says, but they really don't parrot it exactly. They sort of rephrase it a little bit. And maybe that opens the door to a potentially slightly different interpretation of whether or not something is incidental to a principal amount or not. I don't know. But there's not a lot in the proposed rule about this issue.
Okay, thank you. We've only got a few minutes left, but we do have a couple of questions that have come in. Wanted to try and get to those. David, we had a question asking if you could run through the list with the states with no fee statutes again. Would you mind running that off?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll bear with me for 1 second. So those states are Maine, Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, Kansas, Oklahoma, Colorado, in North Carolina.
Awesome. Excellent. Thank you. We did get a question about asking why New York was restricted. mentioning a January Supreme Court decision that overrides the statute. John, David, Mike, anyone want to weigh in on that? Not all at once.
This is Mike from Lucid Pay, and you know, generally we've erred on the side of caution with our clients because, you know, obviously this is a concern for a lot of folks, and you know, that's traditionally been a state where I think it's not been as friendly to our industry, and that was, you know, really from some opinions we've used to, has driven our decision in terms of including that in a restricted state.
Okay, seems fair enough. Thanks, Mike. Thanks for weighing in. Appreciate it. We've only got a we got one more question that came in as I was getting ready. What are your thoughts on the difference between consumer and commercial collections and charging convenience fees? Does anyone want to weigh in on that dynamic?
This is Mike. I would just say that, you know, you're looking at probably a different set of regulations. Obviously, we know the commercial accounts, as long as they aren't defined as a consumer debt, are not going to be governed by FDCPA. Therefore, that 8081, which is the section that you look at that talks about incidental fees, and the FDCPA is not going to apply to the commercial collections. Now, you're going to have to look at your underlying agreements with your clients too, because a lot of those contracts state that you have to follow the FDCPA provisions. So I'd be cognizant of that. The other thing, I would just say that UDAP, the Dodd-Frank Act, I think it's section 1031, 1036, somewhere in there. Those sections talk specifically about convenience fees and UDAP and how that plays out. And we talked a little bit earlier about the CFPB bulletin and the four prongs that we kind of went through, which talked about misrepresentation and making sure that you're providing the information up front to the consumers and clear, concise disclosures and things of that nature. So going through that process and understanding those four prongs, you're probably going to pass muster under UDAP as well. Because whether you're commercial collections or consumer collections, you're still going to have to comply with the UDAP provisions. So I think that would probably be the area that I would start as I walk through that. But you have to look at, since it's collections in general, I would look at all of those statutes as I decide what my policy and procedure is going to be for that specific issue and that type of debt.
Great, thanks. Another question that's come in. Does the FDCPA apply to HOA, which I'm assuming are homeowner association debts? And unless I'm wrong, by all means, somebody correct me, but that's what I think. Does the FDCPA apply to HOA? Does anyone want to tackle that one briefly before we wrap up?
This is Mike. I don't know that I could say in a broad term, in a sweep, that it's whether it applies or not, because those are all a little different. But if it's a consumer debt used for family and household purposes, it may fall under the auspices of the FDCPA. Depending on what type of debt it is, well, underneath that HOA, it may or may not fall under the FDCPA. And I would assume most of it would. John, you may have more insight on that than I do off the top of my head.
Yeah. Well, I was going to visit Bedard. You know, it's not. It's not the kind of debt necessarily that is regulated or not regulated by the FDCPA. What matters is whether or not the obligation arose out of a transaction in which money, property, insurance, services that are subject to the transaction are primarily for personal, family, or household purposes. And so if this particular debt, HOA debt, as in the example, arises out of a transaction, the primary purpose of which is personal, family, or household use, well then yes, it very likely will be covered by the FDCPA. But if the answer is no, for example, if the purpose of the obligation here is to purchase property for investment purposes, and that the people that own it might owe HOA dues, but the purpose for which they owe it is to maintain a commercial property that is used only for investment purposes, that's a vacation rental place, something like that, well, then that may very well not be an obligation incurred for personal family household use because it's a commercial purpose, an investment property. So it's not necessarily the character of the kind of obligation, HOA, credit card, blah, blah, blah. What matters is the purpose for which that obligation was incurred that determines whether the FDCPA applies to it.
Got it. Thank you for the clarification. Well, we've just about run out of time, but before I let our panel go, what I'd like to do is give them each one more chance to share any parting thoughts, any key takeaways, maybe any other ideas or perspectives they didn't get a chance to share today based on where the discussion went, but thought were relevant or important, but just a chance to share any concluding remarks if they didn't mind. David, would you mind going first?
Yeah, I don't have much to add really aside from, you know, I think everything that that was covered was really thorough. You know, but I think one of the key points earlier too, which is also in one of the CFPB bulletins, is really just the proper disclosure and communication of the fee. From my perspective anyway, it is one of the critical components here because you can have the right processor, right bank, technology partner, such as LucentPay, et cetera. But if that fee isn't being disclosed properly and they're not being provided, you know, another option, a cheaper option, you know, to make that payment, then they can put themselves in some, you know, some you know, poor territory, I'll say. But awesome. Yeah, that's pretty much all I had.
Thanks, David. Mike Frost?
Thank you for the opportunity to jump in today with this group. It was a good time and fun. This is always an area of the law that's got a lot of questions around it, so there's probably not a perfect way to employ any of it. But I think, you know, kind of the points that we made today was really making sure that those back-end processes, your conversations with your creditors, working as diligently as you can to have as many holes plugged as you possibly can with this issue is going to be vitally important. And whether you're in litigation or having a review from a regulatory agency. So while we have a lot of questions and concerns around this topic, I am one that believes that you can absolutely put a policy and procedure in place that allows you to utilize the third-party payer processes inside your collection agency going forward.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Mr. Bernard?
Thank you, Mike, and thank you for having us here today. You know, the vendors in the ARM space that process payments are experts. They know the concerns that debt collectors have. They know the risks that debt collectors face. And what we tell clients all the time is talk to those vendors. Ask those vendors how they are addressing your concerns, because they really do have broad and deep knowledge and experience about how to help the industry overcome what they know to be the concerns and the risks in the marketplace. And so call your vendor, talk to them, because chances are they have already come up with a solution to the kinds of concerns and risks that face the collection space.
Well said, thank you. One more time, I wanna thank John, Mike, David for their insights and their perspective today. Really appreciate them taking time out of their day to help educate and inform the industry. I don't think that can be appreciated enough. So thank you very much. Also wanted to thank LucentPay one more time for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.lucentpay.com. to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated and asked questions. The recording of this event will be posted to accountsrecovery.net later today. A final reminder to please take a minute and fill out the feedback survey when you get a chance. And I hope you stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Panel, awesome job. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Take care.